In the context of an age where we have imperialist war across the globe and the desire and the threat of the escalation of that war, George Bush has, of course, promised to a century of war, and John Howard shows every sign of backing, this agenda and this aim. I think the question of revolution, which has been one of the things that has challenged and actually managed to stop imperialist wars in the past, the question of revolution, particularly how do revolutions happen and how can we see an alternative to the system that we live under, is an absolutely critical question that we have to be able to address. Because revolutions are usually presented as events that somehow stand outside of history. They're mammoth ruptures of spontaneous anger and activity that act as circuit breakers, ushering in a new age or a new set of ideas or new social constructs, and effectively sort of rebooting society. And I think there's an idealism that surrounds this kind of concept of revolution, that they happen because people become enlightened or small groups of people manage to enlighten the masses. And there's a mythology that goes along with all of these notions, that revolutions are created by small groups of ideologues who then impose their will on the masses, that they're bloody and senselessly violent eruptions, and that they're somehow doomed to failure. But revolutionary Marxists have a totally different understanding of how revolutions happen. And this is an understanding not fueled by mythology or idealism, but based on a material analysis of history, our understanding of the reality of the world around us. And the starting point for us, as Marx wrote in the Communist Manifesto, is that the history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggles. And as Marx explains, these struggles aren't some sort of historical aberration, but they're part of the uninterrupted battle that's always taken place at the very heart of class society. And Marx writes, "Oppressor and oppressed stood in constant opposition to one another, carried on an uninterrupted, now hidden, now open fight, a fight that each time ended either in a revolutionary reconstruction of society at large or in the common ruin of the contending classes." And what Marx called this sometimes hidden, sometimes open fight is really just a way to explain the tension that exists all the time in society between those who run the world and control all of its wealth and those of us who have to work simply to survive. And this tension has often spilled over into open fighting and resulted in revolutions throughout much of human history as oppressed people have fought for better lives. From the slave revolts in the ancient world, to the Paris Commune of 1871, to the French Revolution of 1879 that signalled the end of feudalism and ushered in a new political and economic system called capitalism, from all of these examples we can see that the most of the changes in human society have occurred not in small incremental steps, but in massive bursts of upheaval fuelled by the struggles of the oppressed. But I guess if class societies have always been brutal and revolutions have always been a part of human history or a part of human history for centuries, and if ordinary people have always had to fight for better lives, the question then becomes, well, why are we talking about revolution, when they seem to happen regardless? Why sit in discussions all weekend and address this question? And I think the other question that gets asked is, why do socialists focus so much on our particular analysis of the importance of the revolutionary overthrow of the capitalist system? Well, it's because the development of capitalism not only deepened and extended the constant opposition between oppressors and oppressed, provoking revolution after revolution right to this very day, it also provided, for the first time in history, the possibility of ending oppression once and for all through its creation of the most powerful fighters against oppression that history has ever seen, the working class. And, rather than simply groups of oppressed people like slaves or peasants or other groups, revolutions under capitalism have always involved, as their sort of central force to a greater or lesser degree, the working class. And I think this changes in very important ways both the progress of a revolutionary movement and its potential. Because it's not so much a question of will oppressed people fight back. I think history demonstrates to us again and again that they will. It's how people fight, and it's whether they can do more than simply vent their rage at the system that are the overall sort of questions that I think we need to be able to answer. And capitalism is a system of rampant, never-ending accumulation where a tiny number of people at the top of society benefit from the exploitation of the majority. It's also a system of contradiction, competition and crisis, where the anarchic production of commodities purely for profit results in endless economic booms and slumps. And throughout the 20th century, these booms and slumps have led to deeper and deeper crisis and shallower economic recovery across the global economy. And I think that's a process that we're seeing today with all the concerns about the US economy particularly. Marx showed capitalism was a system built on contradictions, which in turn led to explosions, cataclysms and crisis. And that this process was a regularly recurring and repeated always on a higher scale. And so this kind of dynamic of repetition and escalation gets played out over and over and over again in the system that we live under. And it's these forces of accumulation, competition and crisis which, as the British socialist Chris Harman so succinctly put it, the economics of the madhouse, which conflict with the needs of people everywhere to be able to live decent lives. And I think this sort of dynamic creates within it the very system, creates the fuel within the very system itself for revolution. And I don't think we should just see, though, that it's purely some sort of economic equation, that people have nasty lives under capitalism and therefore they're led to, you know, to fight back so that they can get better wages or, you know, gain some slightly better material situation for themselves. Because capitalism produces as its byproduct war and imperialism. It produces oppression on every level, racism, sexism and homophobia. It produces environmental disasters on a scale never seen before. And all of these issues play themselves out in various ways and affect people's lives. And so the resistance that people can feel when they're just trying to go about their daily lives in this society can be, you know, because of all of the manifestations of the way the system plays itself out, not just purely their sense that there's economic crisis. But as well as creating the fuel for revolution, the capitalist system produces by its very existence its own gravediggers, as Marx so clearly put it, a powerful collective of the oppressed who have identical interests and who, by acting together in solidarity, have the power to bring the entire system to a halt. As Marx wrote, capitalism simplified class antagonisms. Society was just split up into two great hostile camps, into two great classes that were directly facing each other, bourgeoisie and proletariat, or in modern terms, bosses and workers. And the link between capitalist crisis and revolution is present in every revolutionary movement and in every mass workers struggle in the 20th century, beginning with the revolutions in Russia in 1905 and 1917, and in Germany in 1918, which vividly demonstrated the working class's potential to build a new world. Workers in Russia and Germany ended World War I, the bloody imperialist war in which 10 million workers were slaughtered, and they forced their alternative onto the world stage, an alternative where ordinary people, in Russia at least, were able to create their own state, the most democratic, most advanced society that the world had ever seen. And then right throughout the 20th century, workers repeated their opposition to the madness of capitalism on a mass scale, across Europe in the early 20s, in China in 1925, Spain in 1936, Bolivia in 1952, Hungary 1956, France 1968, Chile 1972, Portugal 1974, Iran 1979, Poland 1980, South Africa in the 1970s and 80s, and of course right across Latin America in recent years, Argentina 2001, Venezuela, Bolivia, Mexico and Brazil. And so you can see, I think, from this list of examples that capitalism produces crisis and produces revolution after revolution. The system itself can't sustain people, and this, in turn, leads to opposition. It also produces the working class, which fights for reforms and for changes. And in every struggle in the long list that I just gave you, partly to demonstrate that revolutions happen pretty much every decade last century, workers played a decisive role in challenging the agenda of the ruling class. But our insistence on the absolute centrality of the working class doesn't just come from sort of watching how they fight. It comes from our understanding of workers' capacity to do more than simply fight for reform. Workers can throw up the political and organisational forms that become the nucleus of a new society, a socialist society. Because when workers act to collectively defend their interests, they act in solidarity with one another. You can see that individual people are more or less powerless to change very much about their social conditions. But collectively, workers wield massive social power. they're actually the only force that can act as a counterweight to the might of the capitalist class. And through their struggles, the working class have developed their own methods and strategies for defending themselves and for fighting for their rights. And these methods have not been things that were first theorised in the minds of some enlightened revolutionaries, although the more enlightened people like Marx and Rosa Luxemburg and Lenin just leapt to theorise them once they witnessed them happening. These strategies came out organically, were developed organically through the process of the working class struggle itself. Because if workers don't have any chance of defending themselves, let alone of fighting for gains, they must stand together to challenge their bosses, and they must take part in industrial action in the kind of solidarity that is essential to gain any sort of rights. And even the smallest industrial action, the smallest strike in any corner of the world, contains some of the kernel of the revolutionary potential of workers. Challenge, solidarity, the need to overcome divisions, all of these things, I think, demonstrate that, workers act together. When they act to fight for their rights, they act together. And in the upheavals of the 20th century, struggles which often began on really tiny scale, much, much smaller than any of the union struggles that we've seen today, grew to involve millions and millions of workers in demonstrations and general strikes. And when workers take action on such a scale, bringing the gears of the capitalist system to a grinding halt, their power becomes unmistakable, and a revolutionary challenge is posed. I think workers' struggles pose a direct material challenge. As I said, they can halt the entire workings of the system, but they also provoke a challenge to all of the ideas that exist under capitalism. And people often talk as if revolutions are sort of made by the changing of ideas, that the left and the militants in the labour movement somehow get bigger or more confident or more influential, and boom, you have this struggle for change and for revolution. But revolution never occurs, or it never has occurred in history, because of just the behaviour of small groups or even larger groups of socialists, however big or small. It occurs because the vast masses of people, many of whom might never have considered any such questions in the past, thrust themselves to the centre of the political stage. The French Revolution of 1789 wasn't started by the activity of a handful of ideologues who, were arguing for the Republican cause. It started when thousands of people from the poorest areas of Paris decided to march on the Royal Palace at Versailles. February Revolution in 1917 in Russia started when women textile workers went on strike, sick to death of the working long hours for starvation wages. And such events can seem like they just happen spontaneously. Suddenly you've got vast numbers of people who are out on the street who decide that they can only get what they want by taking things into their own hands. And those who campaign for revolutionary change can sometimes be as surprised by the turn of events as anyone else. I think it's one of the great paradoxes that the class that's capable of creating socialism never really starts such battles with this intention in mind. But in certain historical moments, this initial question around people move, whatever it might be, the thing that moves people into action, sparks off more and more questions as power and confidence grows. And the Polish socialist Rosa Luxemburg described this sort of process quite concretely when she was talking about the revolution in Russia in 1905. She said, "The proletarian mass, counted by millions, quite suddenly and sharply came to realise how intolerable was that social and economic existence which they had patiently endured for decades in the chains of capitalism." She was quoting from a newspaper, and she wrote, "The embraces, cries of delight and of enthusiasm, songs of freedom, merry laughter and humour and joy were all seen and heard in the crowd of many thousands of persons who surged through from morning till evening." She's talking about a mass demonstration in St Petersburg. "The mood was exalted. One could almost believe that a new, better life was emerging on earth." And people often talk of the example of both the Russian Revolution of 1905 and of 1917 as somehow an aberration, or, as something that happened so long ago. Surely by now society has changed and the lessons that we learned from these two great struggles don't really apply today. But in fact, capitalism in the 20th century repeatedly created such revolutionary situations with its great wars and its great economic crises. And capitalism in the 21st century is again creating such situations with its anarchic globalisation of production and finance. in December 2001, for example, we saw massive uprisings in Argentina that ousted four presidents in 2 weeks. And Argentina, at that period, was really the start of mass workers' struggles that were to just, you know, cross the entire continent in the years to come, and that we're still seeing now. And so I wanted to use it really as an example of what a mass workers' movement looks like and the revolutionary potential of such a movement, even though that revolutionary potential, hasn't played itself out, I think, just yet across the continent. So throughout most of the 1990s, Argentina had been a modern, globalised national economy. Its presidents and ministers were, you know, the toast of the establishment, and everywhere they were sort of lauded by economists and neoliberals for being, they'd been able to deregulate and privatise and welcome in foreign capital at a massive rate. And really, that society resembled more or less any other modern sort of global capitalist society. It could have resembled Australia. Then the country was hit by the backwash of a financial crisis that began in Asia on the opposite side of the globe. And Argentina's foreign debt mushroomed out of control. The domestic market for its goods collapsed. Unemployment rocketed. The state froze everyone's bank accounts. And the ruling class was split down the middle over what to do. It was then that ordinary people who had probably never before considered taking to the streets, unemployed, manual workers, government employees, as well as some sections of the middle class, marched on the presidential palace to fight with police for 24 hours before driving the government from office. And in the following months, we saw workplaces of all kinds being occupied, from textiles and printing factories to ceramics and industrial bakeries. And this occupation movement coincided with the growth of popular assemblies and the rising activities of unemployed workers, who were known in Argentina as the picoteros. And I think this is pretty crucial at the time for a continent that has such massive levels of unemployment. The actions of unemployed workers was just a really striking example of the possibilities that existed. And the struggles of workers in Argentina inspired workers right across Latin America. Since 2001, we've seen struggles in Venezuela, Bolivia and Brazil, and the ripples of anger have just spread across the continent. These struggles have challenged the domination of US imperialism, of the most powerful force in society. And though I think they're not all examples of, you know, of struggles that have moved to the point of revolution, they've also brought into question quite critical issues. They've put the notion of socialism, what it is it possible in the 21st century, quite squarely on the world agenda. Since 2001, and, you know, and particularly since the US started pursuing its wars, I think imperialism has become a much more used and much more dirty word. People, you know, understand the meaning of this word once again. And socialism, because of the experience of workers in Latin America, has come to represent opposition and hope. And it all started with Argentina, with the experiences that workers had, as part of that struggle. And I think that everywhere in that society in the time, in 2001, there were people discussing issues that normally only revolutionary socialists discuss. How society can be changed, how to stop the slide into economic chaos, and how to deal with mass impoverishment. And, of course, the ultimate question of what is to be done about this issue of power. And it's precisely this question of power, the question of power, along with the immediate need in a revolutionary situation, or even in a situation of just a mass struggle that's sort of teetering on the brink of revolution, it's this question of power that workers, have to address, because they need to be able to maintain all the material needs of daily life that fuels their struggle. And this, in and of itself, creates another form of organisation that, again, comes organically from the experiences that workers have had. Workers' councils, or to use their original name, harking back to their formation in Russia, Soviets. Soviets were the means that Russian workers developed in the course of their struggle in 1905 against the Tsar of organising their own political and economic challenge to the system. And these Soviets grew out of workplace strike committees that coordinated the general strike that was taking place at the time. They coordinated political actions and strikes and demonstrations, but also, because the workers had stopped producing for the capitalist profits, the Soviets began to organise production and the distribution of food, medical care, transport and the essential services that workers needed. The Russian Soviets, which emerged in 1905 and then much more successfully again in 1917, were utterly democratic. They were elected, the delegates in the Soviets were elected, were immediately recallable, were paid the average worker's wage, and because the Soviets were actually based in the workplaces, they could claim, and they did, represent the entire working class. In Russia, you had a situation where networks of Soviets developed around the country, a system of delegates developed because there were more centralised Soviets, and workers came to see this method of organising as effectively their own state. The Russian Soviets of 1917 organised everything in the course of that revolutionary movement, from political meetings and cultural activities, the redistribution of pay from the highest to the lowest paid, to discipline among workers, to childcare and kitchens, to reduce the burden on women. And Soviets, in all kinds of forms, but really they were based on this experience that that Russian workers had had, appeared again and again in the 20th century. In 1956 in Hungary, in 72 in Chile, in Portugal in 74, and in Poland in 1980-81. And in all these places, workers virtually just sidestepped or smashed their old ruling states and created workers' councils capable of reorganising production for human need. And I think today, the examples that I've raised of Latin America, while we've not seen that sort of scale or the consciousness of some of the struggles of the past, where you've had, you know, workers moving to revolutionary situations quite quickly, we've seen the development of popular assemblies, of workers' organisations, and of workers' control as well, in a more limited sense, in some sections of industry. So the working class, through its power, can set up new systems of production for human need and can stop the system of profit and war. And through this power, their struggles can spill over into revolution. But this challenge, I suppose, that gets posed in such a situation, and when these situations do arise, this challenge is a challenge to the existence of the entirety of capitalism, and particularly the capitalist state. You know, the whole method of organising in this society becomes up for grabs in many ways. And in a revolutionary situation, this creates a situation that we call dual power. And dual power becomes the issue, I suppose, when to all extents and purposes, workers haven't been able to completely seize power in their own hands and rid society of the capitalist power, but they have managed to form their own councils and their own methods of organisation that basically exist alongside the old remnants of the capitalist state. And this situation results usually in a standoff in which organs of workers' power exist alongside a weakened state. And the situation is incredibly unstable because, of course, as we realise, capitalists don't just hand over the control of their society. They go about trying to rebuild their institutions, the church and the state and the bourgeois parliaments, to use the hierarchies of power in the armed forces and the police to rebuild their power in order to destroy the power of the working class. And in this situation, it's important to understand that two classes with diametrically opposed interests cannot share power indefinitely. Workers demand decent living standards, dignity and control over their own lives and their own situation. But capitalists, as always, demand the unbridled right to rule. And every improvement to workers' conditions and every little step forward that a revolutionary workers' movement makes is a threat to their system and their profits. And this standoff that exists is not a standoff that can exist for long. And I think this is probably the other critical point to be made when we're talking about how revolutions happen and how workers push forward. As I'm sure many of you know, the situation in Russia in 1917 was one example of the issue of dual power and a situation. Many of the revolutionary situations that I listed earlier as well were also examples of when the working class was actually able to push forward to this really decisive point, where they teetered on the brink of, you know, going forward and being able to create a new society. Dual power is an inevitable component of a situation where workers move to revolution. Of course, in this situation, when these questions are posed, the role of a group of people, a revolutionary organisation, who actually identify purely and solely with the working class, who are intransigent in defending working class interests, who argue that the capitalist state must be smashed, the role of such an organisation becomes crucial as never before. Now, as Liam pointed out at the start, this sort of is beyond the scope of the 25 minutes here, But there is a session tomorrow night as well that talks about the need to build a revolutionary organisation, the need to build a socialist organisation, and I suppose leapfrogs into the next aspect of the politics that we want to be able to convince people of in, you know, in these sessions. So I suppose, having been given the wind-up, to sum up, I think in terms of being able to talk about how do revolutions happen, we need to start with the assertion, you know, and the knowledge that people fight back in all kinds of situations, in all kinds of ways, even when it looks utterly, utterly hopeless. And I think some of the stories that we've heard over the course of the day, we've heard about the inspiring struggles of French workers, we've heard about the struggles of workers in Bolivia who stopped the privatisation of their water, we've heard about the struggles of Palestinian workers who have stood up for generations now to US imperialism and to the domination of Israel. You can see that workers fight back in all kinds of situations around the world. But I suppose there's three key things that tip the balance from just that anger and that opposition to the ravages of the society into actual revolutionary movements. The first thing is that capitalist crisis fuels revolutionary upsurges, and the system itself creates its own grave diggers, creates a working class that actually has the power to end oppression. The second thing is the working class creates its own political formations and organisational formations within the heat of the struggle. And as the struggle progresses, these formations can start to challenge the existence of capitalism itself. And the third thing, of course, is that we know that class antagonism is always present, but winning, you know, winning these struggles and winning them once and for all actually depends on the existence of a revolutionary socialist party, which is, you know, what we, on a very small scale here in Australia, would argue is what needs to be built here in this country and all around the world. And if you can agree with these basic ideas and take away some of the, you know, the understanding of what it will take to create a revolutionary movement, then I'd urge you to join us.